Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. The first case for argument today is United States versus L.E. Myers Company. Mr. Rubenstein?
Good morning. May it please the Court, Corey Rubenstein on behalf of defendant L.E. Myers Company. The L.E. Myers Company was convicted below of willfully violating OSHA regulations and thereby causing the death of apprentice lineman Blake Lane. The trial turned on the issue of willfulness. And in fact, on appeal to the intermediate appellate court, which was Judge Zagel below, the district court found that there were at least two errors with respect to how the jury was instructed on the issue of knowledge and willfulness. And in fact, the trial court engaged in a series of errors, all related to willfulness, which tainted the conviction in this case. In particular, and what I'd like to focus on with your honors, is are these issues relating to the jury instructions. In particular, the jury instruction which related to how knowledge is imputed to a corporate defendant by virtue of information possessed by employees of the corporation. The judge instructed the jury in this case in a way which essentially compelled the jury to find willfulness on the mere fact that another L.E. Myers crew, was participating in a job 30 years earlier on a work site adjacent to the work site at issue in this case. That crew engaged in an uneventful job. There was no evidence of any safety violations or any accidents or anything which would have caused the members of that crew to report that incident or to do anything about it or anything about that hazard with respect to some future incident. Nevertheless, the judge instructed the jury, and the government relied on this instruction explicitly in its closing argument to argue as this for this as an independent basis for conviction.
Was that – that incident was in the 70s, was it?
1970, Judge. And it was on the Tower 96, which is some 100 yards away from the tower that was at issue in this case.
Before you go any further with your instructional error argument, and I understand that's the main thrust of this issue on appeal, was the admissibility of that 1970 incident litigated at trial? Because it seems to me that's sort of a threshold question.
Sure,
what
Judge.
What relevance does it have to willfulness anyway if there isn't any evidence of knowledge at that time of the static wires location?
Yes, we filed a motion in limine and briefed it. It was subject to extensive briefing and argument before the trial court. And at that time, the judge found that there may be facts which would allow a jury to find that the knowledge of the employees in that incident, in that prior incident, could be imputed to the company. And we were told that we would have the ability to argue, as we did at trial, that the basis and the nature of that prior incident wasn't sufficient to impute knowledge. We didn't know at that time, of course, what the instruction would be, and we argued at the jury instruction conference after or right about the close of evidence that the instruction, which used very familiar language, and that language is the scope of employment. If and it matters within the scope of employment, it concerns the scope of employment, it's imputable to the principal. And that's familiar language, which we see often because it involves agents who, for whom there's no dispute that if the CEO of a company knows of a particular type of conduct or course of conduct or violation, that's going to be imputed. But what we argued and what the district court agreed with us on was that there you have to look at the circumstances of the case. And in this particular case, not because of the nature of this defendant, although that's important, and that is the size of this defendant and how this defendant operates, but because of the circumstances of the information that is arguably imputed, you have to look at whether those employees had any duty to do something with that information. Did they have a duty to tell their supervisor? Did they have a duty to, if it was a hole in the floor, to put a cone around it? Did they have a duty to go to the safety department and say, you know, here is an energized static wire. We've never heard of this before, And maybe this is something that the safety department needs to communicate to the company as a whole. If there was that requirement as part of the instruction, that there had to be a duty to take some remedial steps in connection with the subsequent accident, because there was no accident in 1970, but remedial steps in connection with what happened 30 years later, even if that step was taken back in 1970, if that had been the instruction, then we wouldn't have this issue. Because then the jury would necessarily have found, if it were to rely on this, that some employee had that duty. But here, there was no such instruction. And to the contrary, the jury was informed, and the government argued, and I urge the court to go back and look at our opening brief at page 23, where we block quote the government's closing argument on this issue, because the government tries to downplay the importance of this instruction and the importance of this evidence. But I urge the court to look at that, because the government explicitly argues that all you have to do is read this jury instruction, ladies and gentlemen, and all you have to do is look at this 1970 evidence. And ipso facto, because employees of the company who were acting within the scope of their job in 1970 knew that there was an energized static wire, then the company knew it in 1999. And that's not fair. It's not the law. It just doesn't make sense that you can hold a company that's as sophisticated and large as the defendant in this case with knowledge on that basis.
The district court found that it was error to give the instruction that the magistrate judge gave in this case, omitting that duty to notify higher-ups in the company in order to make it conform to the law, but Judge Sagel said that the error was harmless under the circumstances because, essentially, as I read his opinion, the 1970 evidence was so weak to begin with, it really wasn't the heart of the claim. What's your answer to that?
Well, a couple answers, Judge. First of all, it's not the standard. The standard is harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt. And the judge looked at the record and thought, and concluded, and we think wrongly concluded, that it wasn't significant evidence. But the government itself repeatedly, both before the trial, throughout the trial, the evidence, the opening statement, the evidence, and the closing argument, relied on this. The government said in pretrial issues that the 1970 evidence is critically relevant, quote, critically relevant to the government meeting its burden of proof with respect to willfulness. And the government made that argument in order to get this evidence in. This was a big issue for us, Judge, prior to trial.
Well, that's why I asked the predicate question about right. whether the admissibility of it was litigated, and it sounds like it was. But then it was downplayed on review in the district court in terms of its impact on the verdict, which is really the thrust of the harmless error inquiry. But for this error, would the result have been different?
Sure. And all I can say is the government didn't downplay it. Didn't downplay it at trial. Didn't downplay it in closing argument. Did the government have an alternate theory of liability? Sure. The government argued that even aside from the 1970 evidence, you should find the defendant guilty because the OSHA regulations are so clear that Ellie Myers had to know that it was violating the regulations by not inspecting the static wire on the west side of Tower 97. And that was part of their argument, but it wasn't their only argument. And that argument was a false argument. And the district court's reliance on that argument to find that there was some overwhelming evidence of guilt aside from the 1970 evidence was in error. When you look at these regulations, they're very generic. And in particular, this regulation which talks about determining the existing conditions of the worksite is very generic. It says existing conditions shall be determined before work is begun on or near electric lines or equipment. If that meant that Ellie Myers, which had never before, aside from this 1970 evidence, had never before come across, worked on, or heard about a piece of metal on the top of the tower actually being an energized distribution line, Ellie Myers didn't know it, and Ellie Myers didn't willfully violate any of that requirement. And the district court's repeated reference in its opinion to the presumption in the industry that static that all wires on a tower are presumed to be energized is again a misunderstanding of the evidence. The evidence is that in the industry, of course, electric lines, distribution lines, or transmission lines are presumed to be energized until we confirm that they've been turned off, shut off at the source of the power. So if a crew is going to go work on a transmission line or distribution line, and part of the work requires that the utility turns that power off, then the crew is not to take their word for it. They're to take certain steps to confirm that the energy has been disconnected. And that's what the district court judge, that's the regulation that this district court judge was referring to, and that's the saying in the industry, that if it's not grounded and not positively proven to be dead, then it can't be worked on. But that doesn't apply, and that was never anything that anyone understood in L.A. Myers applied to a dead lightning rod, which is at the top of a tower and is never connected to energy, other than what happened with L.A. Myers Commonwealth Edison converting it in this case.
So the argument is that a static wire by its nature is not charged.
That's right. It's not a static wire if it's energized, and it wasn't a static wire in this case. And the government makes that point. The government says, well, you know, at trial, everyone referred to this as an energized static wire, and that's an oxymoron, and it truly is. But
except
the
if it appears with insulation on it, that must mean something.
If you saw the insulator, if you had a reason to look for the insulator, if you knew there was the pink elephant in the courtroom, and you ignored it, yes. But no, the evidence that anyone saw an insulator here was highly controverted. There was one witness for the government who said that, and the government ran from that witness in closing argument, saying his testimony doesn't matter. We don't need to rely on his testimony because L.A. Myers clearly, you know, just by not looking at the thing, violated the regulations. And Judge Zagel, in finding harmless error, repeatedly said the jury could have found this, the jury could have done this, which is not the standard. It's not the standard, and there's too much of a risk that the jury convicted on the basis of the 1970 evidence. We don't have to prove that they convicted on that basis, but there is a substantial risk that that was the basis for the conviction.
Well, it may be the standard if you're talking about an evidentiary error, but here we're talking about an instructional error where the jury was misinstructed on an element of the claim.
Correct. I see I'm in my rebuttal time, so I'll yield for now.
Thank you, Mr. Rester. Mr. Sussman?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Eric Sussman for the United States. Your Honors, let me address something that Mr. Rubenstein said toward the very end, which is that there was no reason to look at this wire in the static position. And the answer to that, Your Honor, is there was a reason to look. The reason to look was the OSHA standards that required them to determine the existing conditions at the work site. This notion of, well, everyone believed it was a static wire, they assumed it was a static wire. That was the problem in this case. If they had just looked up at the sky, if they had used the binoculars, if they had taken literally a minute to look at that wire and seen the insulator, as Judge Sykes noted, they would have known, and they all acknowledged that they would have known, that this was an energized line, and they also admitted they would never have sent that green apprentice out to that energized line to work on it or to be anywhere near the energized line. I want to come back to this issue of willfulness and the 1970 work. The government, there is confusion going on with respect to this in terms of how the defendant has presented this issue. The issue of willfulness did not revolve around whether L.A. Myers knew that that line was energized and back in 1970, whether that 1970 knowledge should be imputed to them in 1999, such that they knowingly sent an employee out to touch an energized static wire. The government made that abundantly clear in the rebuttal argument, which we cite on page 31 of our brief, where the government argued, of course they didn't know. It's actual knowledge that there are OSHA regulations and they're not complying with them. That's the issue. The issue of willfulness is not, did they willfully send someone to their death? That would be a manslaughter case. The issue here is, did they know that they had OSHA, that there were OSHA regulations that required them to have pre-job briefings, to determine existing conditions? There were five OSHA violations in this case, which the defendant was convicted of violating in this particular death.
Oh, right, but they're stated so generally so that they could mean anything in the context of the case. And what they meant in the context of this case was that there was a failure to take note of the energized static lines.
Well,
the claim has to be considered, or the prosecution has to be considered in the context of its facts. Otherwise, you could have a willful criminal violation of these very generally stated OSHA regulations for any sort of garden variety negligence.
Well, Your Honor, I think that the existing conditions, for example, it's in the appendix of our footnote, it does describe the notion that before any work is performed near electrical lines or electrical equipment, you should determine existing conditions, which include nominal voltage of the lines and equipment, the presence of hazardous induced voltage, the presence and condition of protective grounds, equipment grounding conductors, the condition of poles, environmental conditions. All of those things, I mean, they do specify in the OSHA standards what existing conditions, at least give some examples of the things that they need to do.
But to make your case, Mr. Sussman, don't you have to show that the willful violation caused the death?
Yes, we do, Your Honor. And in this particular case, the jury found for five different OSHA statutes that each one of those individually caused the death of the employee. So it wasn't just, for example, determining existing conditions. It was also pre-job briefing, which they independently found that caused the death. So each of those five violations the jury went through wasn't just, if you find any one of the five, then you can convict this corporation. In the 1970 work, that was limited to dealing with a specific factual claim that the defendant raised in its opening statement and in its statement of the case to the jury. What the defendant argued to the jury and what they've argued here is, look, this was such an anomalous situation to have an energized static wire. It was so crazy that no one working on those lines could have been expected to know that this danger was up there. And what we said was it was strictly a factual response to that. We introduced the fact that actually we introduced a map that showed the fact that there are tens of those energized static wires all around airports in the northern area of Illinois, which is where ComEd worked.
Did you show that Meyer had any of those maps?
Excuse me?
Did you show that Meyer had any of those maps?
No, we did not. We showed that ComEd had those maps, and we showed that Ellie Myers, in their contract with ComEd, represented to ComEd that they were familiar with the ComEd grid, and we did introduce evidence that if Ellie Myers had asked for any of those maps or any of that information, it was all available to them, and they never asked. One of the reasons why ComEd essentially subcontracts this out, ComEd has no responsibility at the work site for what is the safety that's going on. All the testimony that was introduced at trial was that it was the work site supervisors from Ellie Myers that were ultimately responsible. And that's the same in terms of the union contract, which we introduced, and it was the understanding of the Ellie supervisors that were out there on the scene, that they were the eyes and ears of the company, that they were the ones responsible for making sure that they knew ComEd's lines, and that they were the ones responsible for complying with the OSHA standards and doing and making sure that it was a safe environment for their workers. But getting back to the 1970 work, the 1970 work was simply introduced as part of a continuum of evidence to say, look, this was known. We put an industry representative for the union up to say that all the union employees, he was well aware of the fact that there were energized static wires around airports. And then what we introduced was the fact that Ellie Myers had worked on this specific line with an energized static wire in 1970 just to say, you know, their claim that we've never heard of this before, this is so unusual, wasn't even factually correct. They had heard about it. They had worked on it before.
What's the evidence of that?
Well, the evidence, Your Honor, was that there was a work order from 1970 showing that they were replacing one of the they were doing work on near the insulator arm toward the top. I'm not going to say that they were replacing that particular wire, but what they were working on was something that where it indicated that that line was energized. It's unclear whether the line was, whether there was actually power flowing through the line in terms of whether it was turned on or turned off, but it was clearly an energized line with an insulator, et cetera. And they had supervisors there. They had a general supervisor and a direct supervisor there. There was documentary evidence of that. And then we had the evidence from the L.E. Meyer supervisors about what their roles were as supervisors.
So the 1970 evidence consisted of evidence that this job was performed, but not on the static wire, which caused the
Well, on the tower that had the static wire.
On the tower, but nothing in the factual record directly speaking to the knowledge of any employee that the static wires at this tower were energized.
Well, we didn't. The answer is no, Your Honor. And we didn't argue that they had, that there was a, we didn't bring in, for example, a particular foreman who said, I knew this was energized. Our point was they had worked on towers with these things before. They were not as unique or as uncommon as they claimed.
If you were using that evidence to prove willfulness, knowledge, well, then wouldn't you have to come forward with some evidence of that?
Well, Your Honor, I would take great exception with the defense claim that we were using it to prove knowledge. There was that we were using it to prove willfulness. We were using it to prove knowledge, in fact, to rebut the claim that they had never heard about this, had never known it. The issue of willfulness is completely separate from the issue of whether they knew that line was energized. That wasn't our point. We made it very clear that that was not what we were arguing. We never argued they knew. We never argued that anyone, the company or any of the individuals.
That's splitting hairs, counsel. That's the whole basis of this prosecution.
Well, Your Honor, I
it's not just a generic, you know, knowledge of OSHA regulations. I mean, you've got to have some causal link between the death here and the OSHA regulation violation, and it's got to be willful before you can have criminal liability.
I agree, Your Honor, but that willfulness and that connection is not that they knew that the line was energized and that they sent a worker up there anyway. That's not the causal connection. You could take that, and we never argued that it was. The causal connection is that they knew what the OSHA regulations
were.
Right,
but that depends on knowledge that they knew that the static line might be energized and therefore had a duty under the regulations to ensure that it was turned off. I mean, that's the thrust of the prosecution here, as I understand it.
Well, I don't think that's what we argued, Your Honor. I think what we argued is you have a duty to determine whether something is a static wire or not, and that the OSHA regulations, and if you read the existing conditions, it's not limited to, you have a duty to determine whether something is or is not a static wire. They made an assumption
What does the 1970 evidence have to do with anything then, if that's what willfulness is about?
Well, again, I think the 1970 evidence has to do with rebutting a claim that this was such a unique thing in the industry that we had no idea this could ever occur. And I think I think what Judge Zagel focused on when he said it was harmless error, if it was error, you know, he agreed, he thought it was error, but it was harmless error, is the thrust of our argument was each and every one of the supervisors who testified said, we understood what the OSHA regulations were, we didn't determine the existing conditions on this, and if we had, we would never have sent this individual out there.
Why do you need the evidence and the instruction with regard to the 1970 case? I mean, it doesn't make any difference.
Well, I think it doesn't make any difference, Your Honor, in terms of the ultimate outcome.
Your argument. But
why did you fight so hard for it to get it in?
Well,
Your Honor, because
I think that we didn't fight so hard to get it in. We filed a motion before trial to get it in. I don't agree that it was the centerpiece of our case. I think that if you look at what we argued, we were very clear with the jury that we never ever said that L.E. Myers knew when they performed that work in 1999 that anyone at L.E. Myers knew that that line was energized. What we said is that if they had followed OSHA regulations, which they knew they didn't follow, they would have determined easily that that line was not energized.
Do you have it as an alternative argument?
Well, I think arguably as an alternative argument, Your Honor, what I would say is it really came into...
What type of verdict did the jury return on this? They didn't pick one or the other, did they?
Your Honor, well, they picked five different things, which included determining existing conditions at the worksite, pre-job briefings, the fact that the employees were not qualified for the work that they were doing, and the fact that they hadn't maintained a minimum safe zone. So they picked each of those.
Did any of those OSHA regulations require the L.A. Myers to go back over its own records over the last 30 years to see what information it obtained on similar sites?
No, Your Honor. It's just to determine the existing conditions. I would urge Your Honors to – I clearly am not able to – I'm not articulating what I'm trying to articulate well enough. But what I'm trying to say is this issue of willfulness is we did not argue that L.E. Myers knew that line was energized. What we argued was that it was not the unique crazy hazard that L.E. Myers claimed it was. But even if you assumed it was the and we use that as a factual rebuttal to that. Our core argument was always, and we were very explicit to the jury, our core argument was always they knew what they had to do at this line. With any line, and I do think that the existing conditions is specific enough to say you have to at least look at the place that you're working. And I think that's what Judge Zagel ultimately found in terms of, I mean, if they had just looked, and at the very least, I think those individuals acknowledge, the supervisors acknowledge, that they shouldn't have been assuming that things are energized or not energized. They should, at the very least, look.
Isn't that negligence?
No, Your Honor. It's not negligence when they know what the violation – the fact is it's not negligence when they know what the OSHA regulations require and they don't – they know that they are not following the OSHA regulations. That's the crux of the willfulness. That's the crux of the crime in this case. It's not that they were careless. It's that they knew what they were had to do, and they didn't do those things. Thank you.
You've been focusing mostly on the harmless error argument. Are you now not defending the use of this instruction, or do you still wish to maintain that argument?
Your Honor, we do maintain the argument because, as we said, and I'll just say it very briefly, Our position was, and particularly given the evidence that was presented by all the supervisors, is that knowing the conditions, knowing the OSHA standards, all those things were fundamental requirements of supervisors, and those were what supervisors did. So this notion that there needs to be an additional requirement, affirmative requirement, that those supervisors, that the jury needs to be told those supervisors also have to have an affirmative requirement to pass knowledge along to their superiors, our view is that this court's precedent on that issue, which is that is encompassed within the scope of knowledge and the scope of agency requirements, that knowledge or that passing on of information is imputed. And I think that's what the court has consistently said in the criminal context, that when you talk about the scope of someone's employment, the scope of the agency, and you say something is within the scope of their employment, that necessarily implies that part of their job is to pass that information along or have that information become part of corporate knowledge. Thank you.
Thank you. How much time? 2.5.
Your Honors, the notion that the 1970 evidence was just offered in rebuttal and that somehow even matters doesn't stand up to the record. The government brought in very early in the case an engineer from ComEd to talk about the ComEd documents which reflected this work in 1970. And the witness said and explained what happened. And the witness explained that this crew from L.E. Myers, and I know I sound like I'm arguing against my own position here, but this is important because the government relied on this evidence. So it's important to understand that this evidence did have some potential traction with the jury. And that is that this crew in 1970 did work on this particular west side static wire. Now, the static wire certainly was de-energized at the time because they were actually handling it. But they had to move the static wire from one portion of this arm of the transmission tower to another, because the static wire apparently had been blowing into the transmission tower and shorting out. The government went into detail on that evidence in its case, and then in its closing argument, the government says that the 1970 work involved the same exact line that they were going to work on in this case. Not the same tower, but a different tower. And you're going to receive a jury instruction on corporate knowledge, and it states, and the government quotes instruction. And then the government argued, each of the days that they worked on the static wire in 1970, there were people, in the language of the instruction here, acting within the scope of their employment about a matter within the scope of their employment. This says, this being the instruction, says that because those employees had that knowledge, the company had that knowledge. This was clearly an argument imploring the jury to convict on the basis of that evidence. I think this is a yellow light, so I'll keep going. Your Honors, there were five separate OSHA regulations that the government charged were violated here, but the analysis for willfulness is the same with all the regulations. In fact, some of the regulations, like the so-called minimum approach distance, which says no person shall come within a certain number of feet closer to an energized wire than is laid out in a table in the standard, that clearly requires a finding of knowledge that's a potentially, at least, an energized distribution line. But all of the OSHA regulations fall on this issue of, did Ellie Myers have some reason to believe, and did they know that those regulations required it to do something to take a precaution against the potential hazard of that piece of metal being energized? Otherwise, it doesn't make sense. There couldn't be willfulness. And I see I'm out of time now. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. And we